Up next, we're going to talk about some unsolved mysteries and other strange things with two full-time paranormal investigators in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me introduce two of our special guests tonight. First of all, Dana Newkirk, a practicing hedge witch with more than two decades of experience in seeking out the strangest cases of the unexplained. Dana began her career by forming the first ever all-female paranormal investigation team back in the 90s, the subject of Space's Girly Ghost Hunter series. In 2013, she co-founded the Traveling Museum of the Paranormal and the Occult, for which she still serves as head curator. Dana, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Looking forward to this. And, of course, Greg Newkirk is one of the world's only full-time paranormal researchers and has spent the last couple decades tracking down and investigating cases of high strangeness in the supernatural, conducting groundbreaking research on everything from alien abduction phenomena to poltergeist hauntings. Greg is also the co-founder of the Traveling Museum of the Paranormal and the Occult, and again, the world's only mobile museum of the unexplained. And hello, Greg. Good to have you with us.
Oh, pleasure to be here, George. Thanks for having us.
You were with our old colleague Dave Schrader a couple of years ago, weren't you? Both of you?
We certainly were.
Yeah, a good guy, dear friend. So let's talk about the paranormal, and I'll talk to you individually for a while, then just both of you jump in anytime you want. But, Greg, how did you get started in this?
Well, Dane and I quite literally grew up investigating the paranormal. We've been doing it for 20 years, driving around at night, listening to Coast on our journeys into haunted houses as kids, and then we started to get more serious about it. And about 3 years ago, we said, well, let's give this a crack. Let's see if we can do this full-time. And we launched the Traveling Museum of the Paranormal and the Occult, and now we pretty much spend 8-9 months out of the year on the road, traveling from coast to coast, presenting haunted objects, collecting haunted objects, helping people with any kind of paranormal problem, investigating pretty much anything, you name it.
Do you go all over the country?
Oh, yeah, literally, coast to coast, California to Maine, Florida, all over.
What do you drive? I mean, a traveling museum to me sounds like you pick up something in this huge truck or van. What do you have?
Well, believe it or not, it is a Volkswagen minivan.
No.
We're very good at Tetris.
I love it. I love it. And Dana, what is a hedge witch?
A hedge witch is, I mean, a lot of people kind of have different ideas about what it is, but really it's usually someone who associates a lot with the natural world. So they work a lot with medicinal herbs. They work a lot with things that you can find in nature, and that kind of becomes one of the major aspects of their magical practice.
You sound like a good witch. Can there be bad witches?
I think just like people, there's good people
yeah.
and bad people, and I think that really it's all about the intention behind what you're doing. So, yeah, I think absolutely there can be bad witches.
And, Greg, as you travel around the country with the museum, do you find that more and more people are fascinated by all this?
Well, I think that we're in a really good climate for people to be fascinated by it. I think we're seeing a resurgence in the last few years of people getting more in touch with the spiritual nature of things, and they're more interested in that type of thing. And I think that more than ever, they're less afraid of it. We're starting to see people who are becoming less scared of the idea of the unexplained and the paranormal. It's becoming more of a normal thing. That's one of the things that we're constantly, you know, that's one of the biggest messages of the museum that we run, is that most of the time these things that people are afraid of, they're just trying to get your attention. And so I think we're in a perfect place for the paranormal right now.
In the paranormal work that you've done, Greg, have you ever come across anything that even scared you or something you didn't want to get involved with?
Quite a few times. I mean, you know, there's things that I think you'll find with a lot of these things, you don't really have much of a choice but to get involved. Sometimes you're dragged into it. And that happens at least a few times a year. You know, we've got artifacts in the museum that have caused nothing but problems for people, car accidents, things that are believed to be cursed, things that we've quite literally, earlier this year, we had to actually take an artifact back to a cave in the Catskill Mountains that had been stolen from a few years before because it kept hurting people.
Wow. And do you find that spirits and ghosts attach themselves to items?
I think, you know, there's our opinion on this is a lot different than a lot of our colleagues. I think that what happens a lot of times is there are intelligences out there, or there are pieces of us that exist somewhere in some kind of a, I guess for lack of a better word, a cloud, and times of high emotion, times of stress and trauma, they can almost make an upload to that cloud, and sometimes that attaches to specific places and things. I mean, a building is the biggest haunted object of all, and so I think that times of intense emotion create this kind of attachment that when the time is right, or the date or the place or the person, they can tap into that and then they experience that haunting.
And Dana, of course, you and Greg have put together what is called Hellier, a 5-part documentary series about the Appalachian Mountains. How did you key in on those mountains?
Well, we were originally contacted back in 2012 by a man who was experiencing some strange activity on his property, specifically around a mine shaft that was on his property. And after, you know, years and years of kind of looking into this case and really digging into it, we started to notice that there were a lot of similar types of instances happening up and down the Mammoth Cave system and in and around that area. Sometimes people would refer to them as goblins. Sometimes people would call them holler goblins. Sometimes they would have completely different kind of local names for them. But a majority of time, the things that were happening were all the same. So we were able to kind of put together this map, I guess you would say, of where exactly this chain of events was happening.
Greg, was there a specific case that led you to the Appalachian Mountains, or was it just in general?
Well, where we were researching, actually, the name of the documentary is the name of the town where this case took place, Hellier, Kentucky.
They have a town called Hellier, Kentucky?
It is a town called Hellier, quite the name.
Oh, my
God.
And
it's really interesting because one of the things that we had just found out is that the name Hellier actually means to obscure, to cover up, which is what we think was happening in this town. There was a guy who, like Dana was saying, there's a guy named David who sent us photographs of three-toed footprints that were coming out of a mine shaft. These things that he saw, his children, they were tapping on his windows at night. And they described them as little naked children that were bald like Grandpa. And they sounded quite a bit like the Sutton farmhouse attack that happened in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, back in the 50s. And so everything seemed so similar to that case that we started looking at it the same way. And, you know, this guy David was convinced that these creatures that were assaulting his family at night were extraterrestrial. And he desperately wanted us to come and document this. He wanted us to help him blow up the mine that was on the edge of his property.
Jeez.
And he said he was trying to talk to the police, and they weren't taking him seriously. At first, he thought the locals were hazing him, and then it just got so bad, he and his family fled their home. He went back with his brother-in-law to take some photographs and pick up the rest of their stuff, and that was the last we heard of him, and he disappeared. And that's kind of where Hellier picks up, is us tracking down this case. And as we were doing that, we were finding, you know, all of these different similar sightings going hundreds of years back, all along the Appalachians, and people were just giving them different names. They were all seeing the same thing, we think. They just were calling them different things, so no one really put two and two together.
How do you know that this is the real deal as opposed to some trickery or they're trying to pull the wool over your eyes?
I mean, we initially were very skeptical of what was happening. And even to this day, there's still a healthy level of skepticism. We were constantly trying to really keep ourselves grounded throughout this investigation because it does take some pretty crazy turns. So I think that's something that no matter what is always in the back of our minds, and just as far as the investigation goes, we try to remain as skeptical as possible because there is a lot of people out there who could potentially be putting us on.
When you were on the scene, could you feel anything strange? Was there any kind of energy pattern out there?
Absolutely. I mean, that was the first thing that we noticed when we got to Hellier. I've kind of all described it as a feeling of having your brain sort of retuned to a location. It was the first thing that we noticed. It felt strange there. It felt very dreamy, like you had sort of stepped into a different feeling, sort of a place. It was really interesting.
Now, you broke it down into five parts, the documentary, right?
Yes. Yeah, there are five different parts. The first part of the documentary is basically just a recap of the investigation that we had done so far. This is something that's been 7 years in the making, and it's just kind of something we've been slowly chipping away at because there's so many mysteries to unravel. So the first part is just kind of catching up, and then everything from the second episode on is the actual investigation itself.
Were you happy with the way it ended up?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question because I think that any kind of paranormal media and even paranormal investigation itself, it never goes where you think it's going to go.
Right. It always takes you someplace else.
Exactly. And that is really what happened. You know, this thing started out as what we thought was going to be a very simple investigation. We were going to go to Hellier. We were going to find David. We were going to go to his property, and we were going to see what was going on there. But as we started to peel back layers of that onion, we noticed that this was a bigger phenomena. This was stranger than just goblins. It had, you know, part of the reason the case even got picked up again was because our friend Carl Pfeiffer, who was the director, he experienced synchronicities that were just absolutely impossible that were leading him to do this case. It was like the phenomenon itself was telling us, you need to document this, you need to show it to people. And now that we've done that, it's in the world, and we're noticing other people are starting to feel themselves being sucked into this as well.
What's the link with Mothman?
So the second episode is where this pops up. One of the things that happened a year after we got the initial emails was we got two very strange pointed emails from a man who went by the pseudonym Terry Rist. I mean, we're pretty sure that's not his real name. He sent very strange emails that said, the first one said, I have something for you, 1 week.
Mm-hmm.
And then a week later, to the date, we got another email that said, why did you stop when you were so close?
Wow. Was he right?
Well, that's an interesting thing. He sent us a photograph of GPS coordinates, and those GPS coordinates went to Brown Mountain, which was a place we had been just months before.
Mm-hmm.
So this person, whoever this is, knew where we were, what we were looking into, because we were there. Initially, we were there to try and find this entrance to a cave.
Aren't there strange lights on Brown Mountain? Is that the same place?
We've seen them. Yeah, the Brown Mountain lights. They still don't quite exactly know how they've happened, but they're these weird, wispy little green lights that come up out of the mountains and float around.
And they're not plasma balls, are they?
They aren't sure. Yeah. They're not quite sure. The one interesting thing is the mountain is made out of quartz, so they think maybe it could be some expanding and contrasting that's making things light up and shoot sparks.
Okay, and now back to Mothman.
So this guy who went by Terry Rist, the first thing I did was I start to look around and see, you know, who is this person who uses this pseudonym? And the only reference that I could find to this name was in a very obscure book that came out in the 90s called Secret Cipher of the Ufonauts. It was by Alan Greenfield. And it's a book about using magic rituals to contact extraterrestrials. Very fringe stuff, nothing that I was really into at the time. And in the very back, there is an interview between Alan and this man using the pseudonym Terry Rist. And in it, this man talks about using the secret cipher in order to figure out where Indrid Cold lived. And in this, he actually uses the secret cipher to use the words ink and black, which actually meant Indrid Cold. And in the second email that we got from this guy, who called himself Terry Rist, possibly the same guy, he said that the ink and black is still isolated. Well, one of the things that Terry talks about in this interview with Alan is that Indrid Cold had been on the run and was hiding, and that the whole Mothman flap was really a distress signal. Very weird stuff, but an immediate tangible link to the Mothman case and Indrid Cold.
That's dramatic. It really is. And Dana, in terms of your role here as a witch, do you use that in the investigation?
Absolutely. For me, I've always taken magic and utilized it with paranormal investigation. So I'm constantly, utilizing like tarot or creating communication altars, and it kind of is just another layer that we can tap into when we're investigating. So it's always been a really positive thing for me, and really kind of been what drives my style of investigating, I guess.
As you were investigating this particular case, did you know what you were going after, or did it just happen?
I think we thought we knew what we were going after. It's probably the best way to put
Or
it.
you hoped you knew.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. We hoped we knew what we were going after. And really, every time we thought we knew what was happening, it would sort of pivot and acclimate itself and change. So we kind of just went with it, and we continued to investigate it the way that it kind of wanted to be investigated.
We're with Dana Matthews and Greg Newkirk as we're talking about their work, Hellier, which is a documentary. They are paranormal investigators. Where did these goblins pop up from?
Well, the goblins, we started using the term goblins because these creatures that David described were so similar to what happened in Hopkinsville or Kelly, Kentucky, back in 1955, where the Sutton farmhouse was attacked by these strange creatures from outer space. It was a really famous case. There's a dozen witnesses. They've never gone back on their story. So the parallels to what was happening with this case with David, they were so close that we just started saying, well, these are both in Kentucky. We'll call them the goblins because it seems like the goblins have returned.
Were they dangerous? Evil?
Well, the interesting thing is David never said they did anything terrible. Even in the Hopkinsville case from the 50s, the one last relative who still talks about it is Geraldine, who is the daughter of Lucky Sutton, who actually shot at these creatures. She even said one of the things that people don't know about that case is they approached with their hands up. So it was like they were coming peacefully, but they still shot at them. David, his story, they were more mischievous than anything. They were tapping on his kids' windows. They were rummaging through his shed. He was finding their stuff around the edge of the mine shaft. They took a one of the weirder details. They took a wreath, like a Christmas wreath, and shoved it in his mailbox. The only thing they did that I think could be construed as not very nice is they took his dog, and he's
Oh.
convinced that they took him down into the mine for who knows what.
Did the dog ever come back?
Oh no, as far as I know.
Jeez. That's bizarre all by itself. What makes this area such a hot spot for paranormal activity?
It's sort of this perfect place, and one thing that we have been noticing quite a bit is, as far as this phenomena is kind of, what we've been noticing is basically there are a lot of similar things. So Hellier seems to be this perfect spot for this kind of activity. It's on a border, it's an isolated town, it is the perfect kind of place for this sort of phenomena to happen, and people wouldn't necessarily take people seriously because of the area.
One of the things that we keep hearing is there are plenty of places for this type of thing to hide. We've been getting, now that Hellier's been out for a week, we've been getting locals who've been emailing us saying, my grandmother told me, don't ever follow anything that looks like a child into the caves, because they're not. And they were deadly serious about this.
They're tricksters.
So there's tons of cases of these types of things. And they're just better at hiding. Even things like, Point Pleasant, West Virginia, the flap happened there. There's something about the Appalachians and something about the Mammoth Cave system in particular.
Hold on for a second, Greg. We'll come back and talk more with you and Dana about this very strange story and then some more unsolved mysteries next. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Dana Matthews and Greg Newkirk, as we talk about their documentary, Hellier. And of course, the documentary is out. I'm getting emails from people who have seen it, Greg.
Fantastic. I hope they're good.
Yeah, they are. Matter of fact, here a couple questions from one. Justin in Dayton, Ohio said, why didn't the team actually explore the train tunnel or the caves?
So there were a few issues with the train tunnel. One of them, we did explore quite a bit of the train tunnel, but it was extremely dangerous, and we weren't prepared for it. You can tell we're not wearing hard hats or anything like that. What happened when we went to Helliers, we thought we were going to be in a guy's backyard checking out goblins, and things did not quite progress the way that we anticipated, so we were just flying by the seat of our pants. I mean, what everyone's seeing there is it's a very real-time paranormal investigation, but that doesn't mean that we haven't been back.
Mm-hmm. Have you?
Well, I don't want to spoil season two.
Good point. Now, he also wants to know about somebody named Terry Rist.
Yeah, so Terry Rist was the guy who sent these mysterious emails with the GPS coordinates talking about how Hellier
the guy.
He said that Hellier was a symptom, and that's sort of what we found out in the first season. And
were you able to trace his IP address, he wants to
know? We were not. So there's a whole scene actually in the fourth episode where people will see us trying to find David and trying to find Terry. A lot of the Terry stuff didn't make it in, but their IP addresses were very different in very, very different parts of the country, and that's about as far as we got with those.
In the investigation, what did you two expect to find?
I think we were hoping that we would find David and kind of be able to kind of put closure to what we already knew about the case. And every time we would, again, get a little bit of closure, there would be five or six more questions that would pop up at the same time. So it was sort of this real-time investigation where we were really just running in the directions that felt the most compelling and that were really yielding the most information.
Were there any times that you thought you were going to come across some body or something like that?
I think there were times when we thought that people might come across ours.
Yeah, that's true. Thank God that didn't happen.
Yes, me too.
There's still time. We'll see. We are shooting the second season right now.
Well, this one's got it's kind of like a cliffhanger, isn't it?
Yeah. Without spoiling too much, there's a pretty massive cliffhanger at the end of the first season. And one of the things that we've been telling people is, you know, Hellier, the first season of Hellier, really is a prologue to a much bigger scope. Again, you know, one of the things that Terry had mentioned in one of his emails was that Hellier was a symptom. And that really is what we found. The scope is far broader than this one little tiny coal town now, and that's sort of where we leave off.
What does the town say about this area?
Well, that's actually a really interesting question, because the first time that we had gone to Hellier was in 2015, and we were just dipping our toes in, trying to get a feel for if something like this could have actually happened there. Because at that point, you know, we were even more skeptical. And we took the photographs with us, and we showed them to townspeople. And there's basically one hub in Hellier, and it's the local gas station. And it's the gas station, the post office, the pizza restaurant, everything is right there. And any good paranormal investigator will tell you, you go to where the hub is, and you just start asking questions. And that's what we did. And, you know, within half an hour, there were two dozen people who were telling us all of these stories. They were telling us about UFOs the size of football fields that were hovering over the place. And then, you know, our second trip there, which was 2 years later with Carl and Connor, our other investigators, it was a totally different vibe. I think people were a little more distrusting because we had camera equipment and we clearly didn't look like we were from the area. And it took us a while to warm people up, to get them to tell us about some of these strange things that they were experiencing.
Now, you've dealt with other paranormal things before. Both of you have. How would you categorize this case in the Appalachian Mountains compared to some of these other places you've been?
I mean, this is way less straightforward. Dane and I come from ghost hunting backgrounds and paranormal investigation.
Right.
We're dealing with very, very ghosty stuff, poltergeist, things like that. This is so much bigger and stranger and weirder. We're not ufologists, and we were dealing with UFO stuff. We're not cryptozoologists, and we were dealing with strange creatures and strange footprints. Much broader and a lot more difficult to track down, because it seems to us like the phenomena shifts and shapes depending on the time period and depending on how people are looking for it. It's very elusive.
What is the so-called Estes method? What is that?
So the Estes method is a method that our friends Carl and Connor, who again are fellow investigators, actually came up with in Estes Park, Colorado. And it utilizes a spirit box, which is a pretty common ghost hunting tool.
Right.
A set of really good headphones and something to cover your eyes with. And basically what you're doing is you have a person sitting with the spirit box and the headphones plugged into it, and they're listening to what's coming through on the spirit box. And then you have the other investigators that are sort of standing around this person asking the questions. And the idea is that the person with the headphones on is completely cut off from the rest of their senses. So if the questions that we're asking line up with what the person is saying, then that's something interesting. We can kind of look at that as potentially something else communicating with us. So that's the Estes method.
Now, the spirit box, is that the one that George Meeks invented?
I think that's close. I think it's a variation of that, yeah.
Okay.
The SB7 is the most popular one, and it's been on the market for 10, 20 years, and it's pretty divisive in how people use it. I, for one, am not a fan of them, but after I saw the Estes method performed, I was blown away. I mean, the answers and responses that come from, you know, the person who's acting as the receiver, who is not hearing the questions asked, that's stunning to me, and I think that's whether that's coming psychically, whether that's coming from some sort of technologically assisted mediumship, I don't know. But it's interesting enough that it's made me respect the method.
What kind of other equipment, Greg, do you guys bring?
I mean, anything from thermal cameras, night vision cameras, things like that. We don't make a lot of use of them in Hellier. Because really what people are seeing in Hellier is they're seeing a lot of the boots on the groundwork. They're seeing us talking to the locals and trying to get information from the locals. One of the things that we make use of quite a bit is the fact that Dana is a fantastic tarot reader. And she tends to pull tarot on most every investigation we ever go on, because regardless of what you think about it, it kind of makes you take stock of the situation at hand and think a little bit differently.
Does tarot for you, Dana, have you change events or the way that you're going to do something?
I think absolutely it has. For me, tarot has always been this really great tool for paranormal investigation because it gives you insight into something that maybe you don't necessarily have quite on the surface at that point in time. So it's this really great tool for me, and especially throughout the investigation. And I use it quite a bit in Hellier. When we get to points where we're sort of just looking at each other going, what direction do we go in next? And it can tend to be this really great conduit for kind of pointing us in a right direction. So I'm constantly using tarot through our investigation.
Lots of compliments on the videography of the documentary. Who shot the thing?
This actually, the reason the whole project happened was because of our friend Carl Pfeiffer, who's an incredibly talented videographer and editor. He's the guy who, he heard me talking about the case, and as I was talking about the case, he was listening, and he watched our website automatically random tweet something about the case that was a crazy synchronicity, and so he really pushed and prodded for it, and he made it look just beautiful. He used wide-angle lenses on it, cinematographer lenses. Mm-hmm. That you've never seen in one of these types of projects.
Now, the fact that you're working on season 2 tells me that you're not complete yet. It's not finished.
There are so many dangling threads. There's so much more to investigate. Again, Hellier is just the start. It's just a prologue. And even in just, we shot this in 2017. People are just seeing it now. It's only been out for a week. the amount of information that we've been able to gather since then is staggering. And I think people are going to be shocked at the things that we've discovered in that time.
What would you hope to accomplish?
I think for us, I mean, we really went into this project with the idea of creating something that sort of pushed the boundaries a little bit because of the nature of what we're investigating. It's a bit abstract and strange. And so really, from everything from the way that it looks to the pacing of it, we really wanted to kind of challenge sort of the paranormal television tropes and the things that have sort of been set in place for many years. And so our hope is really that it inspires people to make their own projects, and it inspires people to get out there and investigate and you know, do it with that kind of passion that
sure.
I think is really palpable.
Historically, how old is this area?
Oh, I mean, it's from the coal boom. One of the things that we found out while we were investigating is many of the roads that we drive up only exist because they were roads that led to the old mines. So it's fairly old. And the other interesting thing is it was a place where the Native Americans, they would only hunt there. So they thought that the white guys were crazy for moving in on this land.
They might have been right.
For sure. I think that they were. And one of the things is a lot of the old Native American legends about the moon-eyed people. That's one of the things that starts to pop up in these areas with these little diminutive people that lived in caves. So again, you see this thread of these things popping up for hundreds of years, and people have just given them different names.
Were there many UFO reports about this region?
One of the first things that happened, again, when we first came to Hellier back in 2015 was, you know, that we had people coming up to us and talking to us about a huge UFO that was the size of a football field that floated above the town. And they were really excited that we were going to listen to them telling these stories because they were convinced that the local newspapers had kind of shrugged it off as just being a weather balloon, and that they, you know, they had government people coming and telling them, no, this wasn't a UFO, it was just some kind of a weather balloon. So that was one of the very first things that we heard specifically from people in Hellier.
And as we continued to do this boots on the ground work, more and more people started to say, you know, there was this other UFO that we saw, and that happened in the 60s, and it was huge, and no one knew what to do, and it was weird because we just kind of stood there and then shrugged our shoulders.
It was like it's like a puzzle, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. For
all
sure.
These pieces just keep falling into place. We're with Dana Matthews and Greg Newkirk. Their websites are all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll take calls with them next hour as we talk about their paranormal investigating. What would you recommend, Greg, to people who want to get into this field, maybe starts, you know, small, but they love it? What do you recommend?
I think, you know, people are always looking for the next big thing or the big haunted house that they want to go and investigate or something famous. But the fact of the matter is there's mysteries in everyone's backyard. I think that's the easiest place to start. You know, when I was a kid, I was investigating the mysteries in my own backyard. And that's the best place to start. And read. Read a lot. And read things that maybe other people aren't reading and have an open mind. You know, one of the things that we've noticed is a lot of these different communities, whether they're Bigfoot hunters or UFO investigators or psychics, they don't talk to each other. They segregate one another because it's always nice to have someone who's a little crazier than you. So we do our best to try and stay one foot in and one foot out, and that's what I would recommend. Everybody just get a little bit of everything and form your own opinion.
And you're doing this full time. Are you glad you are?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we were doing it at night, at part-time, and we had, quote-unquote, real jobs. And so now we're able to dedicate more time to it. We're able to actually work on making breakthroughs in paranormal research, and we're able to travel coast to coast and lecture about this type of thing.
In the couple minutes we have before the top of the hour, tell us a little bit more about the Traveling Museum.
The museum, actually, it started by accident, really. Greg and I have been investigating the paranormal for 20 years, and throughout that time, we've had a lot of people bring us objects that they didn't want anymore from haunted locations, or they've come from our very own investigations. So It actually started a few years ago when we were given the opportunity to give a lecture at an event, and they gave us a table. We didn't really know what to do with it, so we thought we would bring some of this stuff with us, and that's sort of how it kind of snowballed. And now, you know, all of these years later, we have a huge tent that we travel with, and we bring tons of haunted objects and allow people to kind of interact with them and investigate with them and learn more about the histories behind a lot of them.
What has been the reaction of people when they see the museum?
I think there's a bit, there's always a lot of peer pressure that happens in front of the tent.
Yeah.
So you see a lot of people kind of nudging their friends, like, you go in first. But for the most part, we don't travel with anything that is potentially dangerous. We do have a lot of those types of objects, but we would never bring them into the general public. So for the most part, people are, they're amazed. It's really fun to kind of be able to teach them about the history of a lot of the objects and delve into the, you know, our investigations into them and show them how we go about doing a lot of our paranormal investigations.
Dana, do you normally, you know, put any good curses on things or anything like that as a witch?
I constantly, when you think about it this way, all of the objects live in our house with us, so they're essentially our roommates, and some of them are nice and some of them aren't nice.
Huh.
So there's a lot of, I do a lot of energy work, so nothing kind of has the opportunity to get stagnant, and usually when that energy gets stagnant is normally when it tends to kick up and we start hearing weird stuff in the house at 3 o'clock in the morning. So.
And Greg, how about you? You work alone a lot or you work with Dana primarily?
I mean, Dana's my wife, so we're kind of stuck with each other.
Uh-huh.
It's a good thing we're both as weird as one another.
All right, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment to talk more about your investigations and also take paranormal phone calls for you right here on Coast to Coast AM, so don't touch your dial.